Welcome everyone, glad to have you with us again. My name is Henrik. Today we're talking with Jason Erb from Ontario, Canada. His website is Exposing Faux Capitalism, which he started during the global financial collapse in 2008. We have a number of topics lined up today that we are going to hear more about from Jason, such as monetary history, credit default swaps, debt-based currency, compound interest, and how the current monetary system with nothing to back it up really is run on belief, confidence, and ultimately control of information. Stay with us for more. Well, good day, Jason. Hope you're doing well today. Welcome to the program. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, Henrik, for inviting me on the show.
You bet, you bet. We have some interesting stuff on the table today, on the plate, some things related to economics, gold, all things currency related and everything else. And I wanted to just, I guess, ask you about some of your interests background-wise first. Here, Jason, is a way to kind of introduce you a little bit to our audience and when you started your website.
So I started the website at faux-capitalist.com back in 2008, and it was right when the whole economic crisis was breaking that I had been following it very intently for the year prior to that. But what I wasn't aware of until just the year before, and especially when it started breaking in 2008, was even about these credit default swaps, as they're called, about unregulated insurance policies, essentially. And it was very different to compared to the Canadian experience that I was used to, that we have, a lot of us have heard about how the Canadian banking system was rated the most sound in the world. And so we didn't directly get impacted by that in terms of that particular aspect of the economic system blowing up, but all the collateral damage that the whole world felt, and then Canada being so tied in with the exports to the United States and even financially overall, more of an integrated system that we're moving towards. And so I was really seeing it all play out. And then what I realized was that it was actually a historical development, that there are these super cycles that blow up. And this is what we had with the Great Depression. So this is what was cited, was that this was the biggest economic collapse since the Great Depression. But there were some strange things about it, that people who told me that when they lived through the problems in around 72 and then in 1980 to 81, that they noticed more poor people. And the thing is, now I think the big thing is with credit, the kind of credit that they have has been able to prop things up. And then we certainly see this with the money issuance that the Federal Reserve Bank has been doing for the world, essentially, with over $1 trillion in Europe. So all these things were playing out, but what I had started doing around that time was, there was another radio program that I was listening to, and the host was talking about these books that were written in the 1800s and early 1900s that were describing the kind of things that were taking place at the time, not with the specific monetary instruments necessarily, but in terms of talk about, oh, we need to go to gold as the solution, and you need to have some regulation, with others arguing that there should be hardly any regulation. So I really saw it in the whole historical context, and that made me just more interested in writing. And shortly after 2008, I started getting right into a historical take on the issues with the context involved there. So not just focusing on the latest data, but putting it in the whole context of monetary history that goes back, at least going back to the 1700s, with the founding of economics by Adam Smith.
Indeed, exactly. I want to talk a little bit more about the historical aspects, you know, getting to the basics of what money is and everything, how, you know, how it works and functions and everything. But and I also want to get into the reformation, of course, of the economic system, both that's underway now and what you see that going in the future. But in terms of the super cycle blowouts or blowups that you mentioned, I find that pretty interesting as well. It seems to be in an interesting way, it seems to follow a natural pattern, although it's a very unnatural system that has developed in terms of economics. But what do you think drives those super cycles, if you will?
From my research, has shown me that it's the fundamental issue of the way that most of the money is issued as debt. And right now, that even looking at the United States, and of course being the world reserve currency, so around 60% at least of the foreign reserves held everywhere in U.S. dollars. And so it's important to focus on them. And what we see is that over 95% of all the credit and the Federal Reserve notes themselves, they only account for about 3 to 5%, but the actual credit is like 95%. It's credit issued by the privately owned banks. And it's a direct consequence of having compound interest attached to those debts. So when they create the money, that there's not enough money that's created to go and pay back the interest that's due. And the thing is, individually, you can go and pay back your own debts. We see that all the time. But in the aggregate, I would even say it's fraudulent, because any contract that's not possible to fulfill is considered void. And so even though the individual contracts are valid, but I would say that in the aggregate, they're not valid. So even though there's not some way to say void all these contracts individually, but overall, I think that they are voidable. This is exactly what goes to the whole creation of these super cycles. And interestingly, like, I even heard a recent talk done by Tom Woods, and he was talking about the Depression of 1920, and he was saying how it's very little talked about. But it's interesting because he mentioned about how there was this correction in the market, and he was specifically making a case, which I agree with, is that government intervention can cause a lot of problems in terms of just putting off the problem. So he said it was corrected within a year. But the interesting thing there is, it was the case of the whole argument is that by a lot of the Austrians is, if you don't have a central bank, then you're not going to have as many problems. But we saw there, they did have the central bank of the United States, but he was specifically talking about how they hardly had any intervention whatsoever. And still you had this issue of there was like a major market correction. And I would say that's specifically taking aside any sort of banking system. That's when you have the issuance of most of the credit and money as a debt with compound interest.
So what do you think should be done in terms of controlling and regulating this process of making money? And actually, before we get to that, maybe we can talk a little bit more about what you see that money actually is then. I mean, you described a little bit that it's basically a debt, based on debt. But you have some interesting other ideas in terms of, the suggestions when it comes to going back to gold and everything else. And I want to kind of get into why you have an idea that that's not the way to go, why that's a bad idea, Jason.
So the definition of money depends on who you ask, because there are some who would say that money is only precious metals, or others would say specifically gold. And I could name specific examples of, there's quite ongoing arguments that take place as to this. And then you have the traditional economists would say it satisfies three different conditions. But the main thing that I have never heard anyone dispute, the main function of money is to serve as a medium of exchange.
Right.
And so whether you're talking about precious metals or whether you're talking about some sort of other commodity, or as I would be advocating, at least for the sovereign governments to be issuing to pay for their own powers that I say are really best left with government. And then most things I would say are not left to government. It's left to the private sector to determine. But for those government powers, I would say that there's no reason that they shouldn't be going and directly issuing credit for themselves. There have been historical examples of this, and specifically interest-free credit that could be paid for in taxes for the useful goods and services that governments do provide. And so even if there's like this focus by some on that you have to have a real store of value, you look at gold, for instance, and it's admitted by some Austrian economists that it doesn't have any intrinsic value. It's just that it has this perceived value over thousands of years where people have found it valuable overall. But certainly it's not good for everything, that if you're thirsty in the middle of a desert, then that gold isn't so useful unless you can exchange it for something more valuable at that time. So that's really what a free market I see is about in terms of currencies. I can fully understand the whole notion of having freely competing currencies. And this gets into a big division is between the free market currencies and government-issued currencies. But we actually see that, for instance, it's said that the Federal Reserve dollars are fiat money, but that's the total opposite of what they are, because fiat means by the sovereign. It means let it be done. And actually, the Federal Reserve notes are issued by the privately owned Federal Reserve banks. There's 12 regional banks. And they're owned by the member banks, of which everyone would have heard of Citigroup, and that they're a particular owner of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, and there's 11 others. And so these are the banks that are going and issuing those notes, and so they're privately owned, so it's not fiat money. That's one misdefinition that was changed. It originally had the definition that I talked about, but then it was misdefined to being not backed up by precious metals. And I would say that I think that at least the usurious banking elements behind that misdefinition, I think they would have deliberately changed it to specifically go and create this false issue between making it about whether the currency is backed or not backed by precious metals, when I think the real issue is about usury, which the historical definition was defined as any amount of interest. It didn't have to do with the arbitrary amount set by law.
Right.
And so this is really, you go back over the, of course, in medieval Europe, usury was a big thing where it was condemned by the Catholic Church. And then you had the whole split within Christianity later with Protestantism. Of course, before that, you had the Orthodox Church, but it was condemned many times. They went and went back on that. You had Francis Bacon went and worked to weaken the whole historical. It was considered very bad to have any lending at interest. And I would say the whole basis for that, aside actually from any theological considerations, would be that if you're charging interest, it goes and chips away at the real main point about the money to serve as a medium of exchange, that it's not supposed to be that you're supposed to make money off that medium of exchange. It's supposed to serve to have the exchange of goods and services between the people. So I say really the usury is at the heart of the monetary problem. That goes back to what I was talking about, where most of the money is issued as debt with compound interest. And understandably, the banks are going to want some sort of compensation for what they lend.
Right.
But the whole issue, and this is where I'm very sympathetic to the Austrian position, is that these private banks have immense government privileges that get them to be able to force that kind of money, or at least have it be too much of an offer for you to refuse, because any sort of private entity, like in the United States or Canada, can go and issue some sort of local currency, but it doesn't have any tying to the dollar. And of course, the dollar is what people really care about. Even within the smaller countries, it's whatever national currency is being used that people really want, because that can be taken all across the country. Whereas if you just had some individuals going and issuing the currency, it's only going to have a limited usage. So this was the big thing, like looking back into the 1800s, when in the brief time that they didn't have a central bank, that this was where the banks were, a bunch of them were constantly going bust, because they didn't have some central authority to go and back up the banks when they would go and issue too much credit, and then people wouldn't be able to pay back their loans.
Hmm. Well, the other side to this is, of course, kind of what you mentioned, that it's not really free market on the banking side of things. There isn't really any competition within it. You know, anyone can't open a bank, as far as I'm concerned, anyway. There are certain things you have to adhere to, and one can't just create a new currency. Although we can, you know, we can get into Bitcoin and all that later. But the idea there is that, you know, the private banks who issue the currency and everything now are also very heavy regulated by the government. But it seems to be a hand in glove kind of situation. And if one rules over the other, it doesn't really matter. Who has the final call on it? It's still going to be a joint kind of effort, right? I mean, if we are to blame somebody, can we look at one of them as opposed to the other, or both? What do you think?
Yeah, I like to look at both and then focus on underlying principles. That there's focus put on in the Austrian school, for instance, on government. And certainly I can specifically point to the fact that you have that the federal government of the United States gave the privately owned Federal Reserve a privilege to be able to issue notes that have legal tender status.
Yeah.
And so no other banking institution in the United States has that privilege. And that's a privilege that's also to issue the world's reserve currency. So that's an immense privilege. But the thing there is that who are the ones who started the Federal Reserve? It's been shown that it was actually the banking interests themselves, the big banking interests with JP Morgan, and you had the Schiffs, and you had some of the other big banking institutions, especially out in New York. And so this is what I see, is to really look at the interaction between the people in government and the private sector interests that are not representing the people, because they're unrepresentative in many ways, not the least of which is being so much more fabulously wealthy than the average person. So they're not able to identify with the needs of the people. And this is actually a big issue of central banking, is that you have the wealth being taken away from the rural areas into the cities, because this is where they would have their reserves and this is where the decisions were being made. And it's interesting to compare, like in the United States, that was totally a banker operation and bringing in the privately owned Federal Reserve. But in Canada, and didn't have a central bank until 1935. And it was actually the farmers who were supporting that, because they actually had a problem with the local and regional banks. They felt that they weren't getting a fair shake with their loans. So they actually thought they'd get a better deal nationally. Hmm. So I think that example like really shows it really depends on what things come into play in terms of bringing in such a banking system, that I think there's a lot of problems with central banking. I personally think that there shouldn't be any central banking other than what's enumerated in the U.S. Constitution or in other constitutions, in terms of having a treasury that takes in the tax receipts and then can go and issue, you say, currency for carrying out government services. But the whole issue with a central bank, though, is that obviously I think the farmers have found out since 1935 that the Central Bank of Canada being tied in with the privately owned Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland.
Yeah.
That started up 5 years before the Canadian Central Bank, but I don't think that they had any idea as to where the Canadian Central Bank would be taken by bigger powers later on. But that's exactly the problem, despite the best of intentions. And they still may be getting a good deal relative to the Federal Reserve System. In fact, I have no doubt, but these centralization efforts can take even bigger, it can go in even bigger centralization directions.
Well, exactly. I want to get to that later. What's happening right now with the international banking system, and then we have, you know, SDRs in place, special drawing rights, and everything. But I mean, the system as it exists, of course, has tremendous amounts of problems. But what seems to be the problem to me, Jason, is not only the system, but it's primarily the people running the system. Because, you know, whatever is created and in whatever modality it's created, it can all go south pretty quick if we have the wrong people in place. And as we know, you know, the wrong type of people always seem to kind of ascend these ladders of these immense structures and centralized systems. So do you have hope in any system that would be created, or is it more about the fact that we need to have just the right people in place? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, but I think that the institution is very key, that you can have some really good people in government. Like, I would say Ron Paul was one of the least corrupted federal politicians, but specifically with corruption, just in terms of with the whole party system in the United States, especially, is very much the case in Canada as well. But due to the money that's in the politics, and the whole party system in the United States is even stronger, at least in terms of at the national level. And the thing is, it's a cultural issue, I'd say. It goes back to what the second president of the United States, James Madison, said, that the Constitution of the United States and the form of government was for a religious and moral people. And for me, the religious aspect would be in terms of spirituality. But in terms of moral, that you couldn't have a form of government, for instance, that would allow you to take money from one group of people and give it to another just based on wealth redistribution. Not in terms of actually providing for goods and services that benefit the general welfare, but just to essentially go and take money from this one group. So that was the thing, that the system of government that was created, especially in the U.S., was dependent upon a moral people. And also Canada is a similar situation, where it's totally possible with a parliamentary system, and we see this all too often, where there's just wholesale wealth redistribution, especially in 2008. That was just so evident, with up to, it was quoted, $16 trillion that were ultimately given to the banks to bail them out by the taxpayer.
Right.
And so that's what the system allowed. So really, I think the fundamental issue, and it's often not talked about too much, but this is what I like to bring in my discussions at my blog and my own radio show, and any of my discussions, is about the whole societal issues and the moral issues as well. So I think that's number one. That's the whole foundation. But then on top of that is you absolutely do need the right institutions. Otherwise, you'll have some people, no matter how good they are, but they're going to at least be limited, if not corrupted, by the system.
Yeah, I remember an article we posted back in 2010 about who received, you know, a lot of the bailout money. And it was just, it was amazing how many, you know, foreign banks were in there, you know, non-US bank banks. We had Deutsche Bank, Bank of Scotland, Barclays over in the UK, Dexia, Dresdner Bank, Commerce Bank, the Korean Development Bank. This just went, this money went all over the place. There's even, later on was revealed that a lot of companies as well, this was just money basically poured down the drain and nothing came of it.
Yeah, that's right. That, we've actually seen with what's happened since 2008, for instance, this came out within about a year of the whole so-called bailouts, was that the banks were actually considered, more of them were considered to be even bigger than before the crisis.
Yeah.
And then also that they went and changed the whole regulations. This is obvious that this came from the big banking interests of, it used to be marked to market. So they had to mark their assets according to the market. But even that was based on these formulas, which had never been tested. Like I was talking about in the case of a super cycle, that for instance, those credit default swaps and the mortgage-backed securities, that it wasn't factored in what would happen in these super cycles, like the Great Depression. It was just in terms of, well, looking back at the last few decades, and then this is predicts exactly what happens, but it didn't take into account those exceptional circumstances. And so this is the thing, is that we noticed that actually the system has gotten more centralized, and that there has been no ultimate fundamental reforms. Like, for instance, you had the one-time audit of the Federal Reserve. And so they found out some things that they didn't know before. They had this phony audit every year prior to that, which only showed a limited amount of the books. But with this audit that came out, there were some very damning things that came out in terms of the huge amounts of money that were given to the European banks, as an example, which I'm sure that the American people had no idea that that's what it was being used for.
Yeah.
But essentially that there was no real underlying reform with the system. You still have the credit default swaps that are unregulated, that you have the banks even bigger, as I was saying. And really it's so significant that even before this crisis, but even now, it's like 70% of all commercial deposits are held by six banks within the United States. So even though comparing with Canada, like they say, well, you just have the six big banks here. Well, actually, the six banks in the United States are almost as big in terms of the amount of consumer deposits they have. Hmm.
So what do you think should have happened if we zoom back afterwards? These banks and, you know, companies included, they should just have failed, right? They should just have, if they go under, they go under, so be it, right?
The problem that I have with anyone who would advocate just letting all the banks fail at that point is this is within the context of inadequate regulation, and also that there was too much regulation. There were too many entitlements that were pushed through the government, like, for instance, where you could have these loans that were financed effectively by a quasi-government organization, Fannie Mae, the mortgages, where they ended up owning half of all the mortgages. So it was actually pushed through the Housing and Urban Development in the United States for people who previously could not qualify because it was based on simple economics. So it was being pushed politically. So I say within this whole context, I don't think it would at all be appropriate to have all those banks completely fail. But at the same time, I wouldn't agree with another solution that would be provided by Paul Krugman, for example, who said that we should nationalize the banks, because I don't know what his timeline would be in that case.
Right.
Mm. That the usual trick, though, even though I'm sure he's like fully sincere, is that you have a nationalization, but then when things are really good, the prices are up, even though the taxpayer went took up a big tab, they can regain some of that money, but those things will be sold off so fast. I think that the whole concern is that for anyone who would just advocate letting all those banks fail, I really don't see even Ron Paul, if he was president, that he would have taken that position, because the whole responsibilities are so immense. And I think I've just found that incrementalism works better. But in a crisis like that, I think the appropriate thing to have done would have been to force the regulations upon those banks, let them stay private, but say that we're going to bail you out in this particular case, but here is what is going to happen in terms of you will be broken up. And the specific reason for that is because you have this whole moral hazard of the banks got too big, that if they failed, then effectively they would be bailed out. I think that if we already saw what happened when just one of the banks went under, and the whole issue there was confidence, like with Lehman Brothers, when they weren't backed up by the Federal Reserve, you just had this one investment bank, which wasn't even very big overall, like compared to the commercial banks, the commercial deposits, but it was this whole confidence thing. It's the same thing with the stock market. And if you would have had all those banks fail, I think there would have been someone within government who would have stepped in, but I don't think if things would have gotten even worse, then I think far worse things could have happened in terms of what the people who would then seize power might have done in that kind of crisis situation. So I think really the thing was to let them stay private and impose some very significant regulations that go to decentralize the system. Because this is what I haven't heard talked about in terms of that if you would have this collapse, it would create one heck of a crisis. But then the other people on the other side seem to be asking for centralization so long as it's in government's hands.
Well, I mean, any system kind of works better in this way. We could even take the analogy of the electrical system or what have you. The bigger centralized it gets, the more giants you have, and the bigger these giants grow. When they fall, the harder they fall, and you had, you know, much more damage when they do. But if you have it among many, many smaller banks, you disperse it, you know, into these kind of cells or pockets. And then if you have small failures, it doesn't take the whole, you know, suck down the whole system with it. This creates these, like, you know, banking black holes, basically. The problem there, though, is, of course, how do you, as you mentioned with incrementalism, how do you approach of beginning decentralizing such a structure that's in place? Is it up to people who handle their banking to go into smaller banks and credit unions and begin on that level first to kind of disperse among locally operated financial services and such? What do you think?
Yes, it definitely has to come from the people. But the great thing about a crisis is that you can accomplish a lot of change, often sometimes not positive, but this is what I would hope for in a crisis situation. That was such a severe crisis that there was an opportunity there. There obviously we saw there was enough time by pumping up the system with the Federal Reserve notes that were issued and the credit, that there was the whole opportunity to stave off a total collapse of the economy. And that was a case where incrementally over all these years, now we're looking at it's 5 years later since the crisis, and there haven't been any of these fundamental changes. They're still talking about with the Volcker rule, who was heading up President Obama's commission to look into this, the Council of Advisors, and they didn't even implement his idea, and he's a former Federal Reserve chairman. So someone with his sway, they wouldn't even listen to him. So this shows the kind of institutional inertia that you have to overcome. But I think this is where it comes down to the people, that in the meantime, if the politicians won't act, then this is where I'm a big proponent of local currencies. We saw during the Great Depression how there were several hundreds of them, even several thousand, over 1,000 of them. And now there's perhaps maybe only fewer than 100 that are ongoing, but this has been increasing. That you would look back to 1990, and that's when you had the Ithaca Hours in Ithaca, New York. And so then there's been several dozens that have been created over that time, where you have people, entrepreneurs within the local community, that start up these currencies and however they want to do it. But the main thing is it's local involvement. And as the people find out about that, the businesses can go and use this currency, they can take them from the consumers, and they find how it circulates. And there's actually one of the founders, a friend of his who was associated with one of the local currencies in the United States, found that gold and silver were not circulating. Those Ron Paul Liberty dollars were not circulating in the community. But when they had the paper credit that was being issued, that was circulating very well. And so that's the case. This is what's happened since 2008, was there's been a big awakening in terms of individual solutions that can be done. And there have also been focuses on more decentralization. So there's been the state banking initiatives as well that's been led by Ellen Brown especially. Mm-hmm. And so at least I think that's more, it's already been shown to bear more possible fruit down the road than looking at it federally, because that the United States Congress is the least representative government in the entire world, I think, next to India, in terms of the number of representatives per population. That China has better representation in terms of the sheer numbers of representing the people than the United States Congress does. So that at least you would have a better chance at the state levels with the 50 states. That a bill did come to in California to Governor Jerry Brown's desk. And this is the amazing thing, despite the House and the Senate there passing it, that he vetoed it. So we can draw our conclusions in terms of why he may have done that. That wasn't actually to introduce a state bank, but that was just to even study it. But at least that's a case where it actually had gone to the chief executive of the largest state in the union, whereas there's been no such bill that has even gotten a hearing in a committee at the federal level. So I just find as we go more local, that's where really the action and the solutions lie.
Right. And just to go back to that point again, that anyone can decide what money is. People buying and selling can determine among themselves what has value. And you know, I find that interesting as well with a majority of currencies. And I'm not too informed about it, but I've heard, for example, during the Middle Ages and stuff, there was, you know, several different currencies that actually served multiple different purposes. For example, you didn't use one currency to, let's say, save money with, but one was used to, you know, spent on the market, market for fresh produce, let's say. So it was something that was spent that day usually, and if it you know was going longer for that period, it was, you know, it went inert, kind of thing. But would different currencies be able to serve different purposes, do you think, Jason?
I think that's inherent to the kind of currencies that we're talking about. You look at gold, for instance, and it has been historically deflationary, meaning that the value has gone up over time more times than it hasn't. And you look, for instance, that gold's value dropped so much between 1980 to 2001, but then we noticed the value has gone up so much from around $250 an ounce in 2001 until around $1,300 now, and it got all the way up into the $1,700 range within the past year. And so that's a case whereby, for instance, that you had during the Great Depression. Now, this is where it was done through law, which I would say was instigated by the bankers, was that the price went from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce through law. And there were other times by law than when the gold was given a certain ratio. And so gold has historically been deflationary, meaning that it has more of a store of value, really, than a means of exchange. And whether it's the government forcing it, in the case of governments holding a lot of the gold, like at Fort Knox, at least that's where it was taken back in the 1930s. We don't know how much is physically there, or in terms of whether it's been pledged away, like when Germany went and asked for some of its gold from the Federal Reserve, and they said, okay, yeah, if you wait about 7 years to get what you requested. So there's people speculating whether they even have it or whether it's been pledged away, that they're trying to get their hands on it. The point with gold is it's a scarce resource. So the properties of the currency determine its usage, I would say. So even though gold has been used as a medium of exchange, but it was only around 2,600 years ago that you had gold being used in a big way with coins. And so that increased its usage as a medium of exchange. But prior to that, it's been talked about, like how in Babylon, that it was used as a big store within the temples that they would create. It would just hang around there, and it'd be a tool of the power that the priest class would have. And it wasn't really serving any really good usage in the marketplace. And so this is, of course, what we notice with all the gold that the IMF has, for instance. There's absolutely no good it's doing sitting in their vaults right now.
Yeah.
And even with the Federal Reserve, like what good is that gold with the Federal Reserve doing serving the people? That the whole notion is, for instance, India went and bought a whole bunch of gold shortly after 2008. And part of that was because they had to boost their gold holdings relative to other big countries. And so this is at least the expectation that's put out there, is these countries should have a certain gold backing, because the thing about gold is that it has historical value that's been attached to it. But you look on the other end of the spectrum, that you have paper notes. And I think a really great example that hardly anyone has heard about is you have the Bank of Venice, which operated for several hundreds of years in the Venetian city-state. And it's been reported that they actually had their paper documents trade at a premium over gold based on whatever the relative value was of these documents relative to gold, that it traded at a 20 to 40% premium. And when it got up to 40%, they didn't like that, because too many people were, it was causing an issue, and then people wanted to store those documents. So part of it is that certainly paper, of course, you can have more problems with it being counterfeited and right, and lost and destroyed. So that's obviously one concern. But again, I think the properties are an important thing. But again, it's the case of the administration as well is also very important. That example shows that if you administer the issuance of the currency, that it doesn't matter that it has to be some precious metal that doesn't tarnish, and that you can divide it 16 ways, and each of those 16 parts is as valuable added up together as the entire piece that you originally had. That's one of the important things about gold, for instance, that is considered valuable. But you didn't have that, of course, with the paper. And it didn't matter that it traded at a premium because of the responsible issuance that took place over several hundreds of years. So the property is very important, and that is why gold, for instance, has historically been used. But the what I also like to look into is about the issuance. And this is where I think, for instance, Bill Still is right on when he talks about that what really matters is the quantity of money that's in circulation. It's not about actually what backs up the money, but the quantity, because ultimately that the value of anything is due to people's perceived value.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's what's so interesting about this. It's nothing has a value. There's no universal law written or unwritten out there that determines this. This is, again, just back to that simple point. This is an agreement, a decision that's made among people that they, I mean, that's why the monetary system is largely based on belief. So the trick there, I guess, as well, on top of that is, okay, well, how do you then, regulate to a certain extent, but kind of harness that belief in a way so that it doesn't get out of hand. I mean, I've seen many times that, for example, the scare of something falling or collapsing, for example, is enough to actually make something fall or collapse. If you have a news, you know, service out there tied to stock markets and everything else, if the right or wrong information gets out there, and this could be accurate or not, something can stand and fall on those rumors, right?
Yeah, that's right. That goes back to what we had all noticed, and I was really noticing this with 2008, was it was about confidence, because when you had Congress, the House actually first voted down the proposal to go and have the whole TARP plan there, which was later proven it was under false precepts that it was sold, with the Treasury Secretary at the time saying that this would be used to go and buy up the mortgages that supposedly had caused the whole crisis. But then we noticed that the whole issue was just the amount of concentration of these debts with a few banks. It was just so significant, and they had made all these bets that they couldn't go and back up. So when the Congress first went and voted that down, there was this big concern. But actually the stock market went down more at least one other time than that vote. So it's about the perceived issue at the time. And it was really about confidence. This is what's been pointed out, is that it's really not about, like, in terms of determining the value, it's a perception, but the overwhelming thing is confidence. If people don't have confidence in the system, they'll just go and run away from that.
Right.
And so this is really the thing, is that it's important that you mention this, because if you look at paper money, for instance, which right now in the United States only accounts for 3 to 5% of the total money supply, but the real thing is credit. So what people are talking about is the actual credit in most cases. And really that's not a case of it not being backed up by something people would say tangible, of some sort of commodity. The ultimate issue there is about confidence. And this is because people are not feeling confident that the U.S. government will ultimately be able to not even ensure the value, but not even that they will be able to eventually pay off all their debts that come due all the time with the different bonds that are issued. So you have this figure of $17 trillion that's put out there. But then that's all divided up into different bonds where certain amounts come due at different times. And the ultimate issue is whether the bondholders feel confident that money is going to be paid back. And this is where you hear the term bond vigilantes and the whole notion of vigilante justice. They want to get you thinking of these people who are acting in a criminal way on their own. But I would applaud the so-called bond vigilantes because they're the one who are going and waking people up to the fact of whether there should be any confidence in the system as there is. So they're giving people an early warning sign, like the canary in the coal mine. Like, they're blamed for going and ruining markets. But I think it's great when they go and draw attention to the underlying confidence or lack thereof in any sort of financial market. And this is where it's so crucial. It really is about confidence. It's not about what's backing up the money supply.
Well, is that what this is about, really? About exposing unsound, principles, kind of that things are built on a shady background or like an unstable fundament, to use another analogy. I mean, this is, I think, as well, why the economy is kind of tied to a very, very natural cycle. Although the system can be viewed as very, very artificial, it's still kind of tied to the, well, for lack of a better term, the collective human psyche, if you will. So one of the dangers there is that if you manage to, through media and other, institution, kind of spread distrust, if you will, that could be enough to cause a major crash. And as you said, there's both advantages and dangers in that. But is there such a thing as, overtly putting out, bad press, if you will, about something that actually will kind of egg on that process? It will cause more disruption that actually would be necessary.
That's a big concern that I see, that there's this view that the monetary system needs to have a controlled demolition, as it were, that it's very dangerous with the kind of media control that there is in the world, but especially looking at the United States and then appealing to the American citizens who are living in the country of that goes and issues the world reserve currency, is that it's so easy to go and control opinions there. So, like, you got me thinking that if it was put out there, now we want to bring down this current system, now we want to go to whatever other system, all they have to do is get the commentators out there. It'd be the reverse of actually what we've seen. Is
exactly
what I noticed was there was so much hyping up saying that, oh yeah, things are going to be great soon, because obviously that they don't want the whole system collapsing until certain controls are in place. And so what we saw was on the side of going and saying, don't mind about this. Like, we noticed with Jim Cramer saying there's no problem with Bear Stearns just like not too long before it completely collapsed. And ridiculously, you had the ratings agencies that went and valued these credit default swaps. And like, for instance, they actually, one of them, I think that they all said that Enron had a AAA rating the day before it went completely bankrupt.
Right. Yeah.
So we see on that side of how they're able to create a false perception there. And through the whole bureaucracy. Now, this is a problem, because what I found with studying various different issues is that you have the decision makers are going and relying upon the bureaucratic experts, so-called, and they're just deferring, not having a knowledge themselves that, like, especially in the United States and in Canada, there's a lot of lawyers, whereas in China, and I've seen this, is like you have a lot of engineers, for instance. So there's a different mindset that goes on in government. But because you don't have a more balanced representation of people with different skills being brought to the table, that obviously the people who are familiar with the law, then if they're not experts in finance, they're going to rely on the institutional bureaucrats and the ones that will be produced as advisors on these issues, and therefore they're not going to be able to even have the kind of knowledge to go and make informed judgments about the system. So this is one case I'd say where it's inherently bad having a centralized system as exists now, with even you have when the Federal Reserve chairman is appointed and then supposed to be reviewed by the Senate. How many of these senators actually have any idea about what really goes on there? How are they able to at all go and fulfill their advice and consent capacity that they're charged with doing so, when hardly any of them have any sort of direct financial background whatsoever?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're in the blind, and this is just kind of a force that everyone is, you know, trying to understand it, but also predict its behavior or where it's, you know, going and everything. But let's not forget as well, of course, that the right people in place, they make a lot of money during these artificially induced crashes as they've been coming on a regular cycle. And I think that, you know, that goes back to the heart of the matter again, that you have a consolidation of the power of the system happening in these instances, and you have a lot of people trying to take advantage of that. And that's just, I guess, that's just natural. But again, is there any way to, there's no way to prevent that, is there?
Well, I think this goes back to broader issues of, for instance, the concentration of the media. And there's several specific issues relative to the American case that you actually have the official Supreme Court decision that money is equal to free speech. And so this isn't the case in Canada. And for example, that's why you have in the political election campaigns that you hardly have much money that's being donated, and the restrictions are upheld in terms of what can be donated, because there isn't this whole notion that money is free speech. And of course, those with the most money are able to have the most speech, but that violates the basic principle about speech, is that everyone has a voice one way or another, whether it's directly with their voice or things that they can do. But corporations, and depending on the amount of money they have, can have even bigger voices, and not just based on people of differing interests and abilities coming together, but it's just in terms of the capital that they muster to go and direct the politicians and the regulations the way that they want. So one of the things is to deal with the matter of the political system of I'd say the erroneous decision that money is equal to free speech. And then also with the media, that for instance, like you have the United States, only one of two countries where they can have pharmaceutical drug advertising. And again, that's directly to the consumer. And again, that's goes back to a certain notion of, we don't want to restrict free speech, but then we notice that there's restrictions and other things that the federal government undertakes. So there's not some consistent message. And with the whole notion about the media, that if they violate their license, it can be revoked. But otherwise, you know, as long as you don't say these seven bad words, then pretty much everything goes. You can lie. This was directly upheld that it's up to the individuals to go and discern whether the truth is being told by these media operations, even though they're holding a license to be able to broadcast. And just the whole media concentration, that for instance, Canada, there's restrictions that one single owner can only own a certain amount. And I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%. And then there has to be majority Canadian control. But in the United States, there's no such regulations to that degree. And so we directly see with the kind of media concentration that exists in the United States. And this is the thing, is I've found so many issues that, like, for instance, your show and my show and so many other alternative shows are able to put out a different message. But how many people have even heard a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about in terms of about the Bank of Venice, about what money really is, about having a decentralized system with specific examples, that if it wasn't for the alternative media? But then you have, unfortunately, these privileges that are given to the mass media operations that specifically reward them, that you can't go head to head, that to get a new license to be able to compete with them, they'll just try to buy you off.
Yeah.
More and more consolidation.
Exactly. Yeah. Fewer media companies. And it's very, well, ultimately, again, though, I see this as a as a very positive thing. Might be counterintuitive to a lot of people, but larger and larger these entities grow, the more stupid they become. They lose connectivity with what actually is going on, and that's of course one of the reasons why more and more people are turning away from those media outlets, and they realize that something is horribly wrong, because what they experience and what they see out there in the world is not what's being represented in the press, in the media, and everything else. But why don't we take a short little break here in a little bit, Jason? And I have much more I want to ask you about, many more issues I want to get into with you about. But why don't we talk a little bit about your website again? Give out some of the details there. I believe you have a couple of upcoming events, and if there's anything else you want to kind of give out here at the end of the first.
So my website is faucapitalist.com, faucapitalist.com. And that's based on false capitalism, which actually, interesting side story, is when I founded the website, I was under the assumption that capitalism was the good thing. But then I realized that faux capitalism is actually everything contrary to free enterprise, that it's really free enterprise that the United States especially was based upon by many of the founding fathers, relative to the British system that was in place at the time when they had their empire. And so free enterprise is specifically about people exchanging the value that they have relatively free of government, versus capitalism is based on a small number of people having large amounts of capital going and controlling the whole economy. So that was an interesting learning perspective for me. And then I'll be having a talk in Toronto on November 16th the site is conspiracyculture.com that you can go to for details there for anyone who happens to be there, or there'll be a video that'll be posted afterwards. And I'll be looking forward to discussing about different alternative currencies and how there's been a misrepresentation, and unfortunately even within the alternative media, about successful government-issued currencies and interest-free currencies that have been intentionally sabotaged by the big banking interests throughout the past several centuries.
All right, very good. Faucapitalist.com. We're going to have that linked up. And Jason mentioned an important point there, of course. What system, if any, leads to more options, to more freedom, free enterprise, free markets? That's the questions to ponder upon. But we'll take a short break here, Jason. We'll carry on with much more in the second segment. So stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back.
Just a man.
As we proceed in the second hour, we'll talk more about one world currency, the World Bank, Bank of International Settlements. And then we'll get into regional currencies and alternatives such as Bitcoin, Mountain Hours, and others. We'll talk more about how Europe went from being against usury or interest to favorite. And Jason takes it all the way back to Grecian BC times. Later, we'll zoom forward and discuss the future of the euro. So many have speculated that will collapse and countries begin to opt out of the centralized government clutches. But the question is, can it and will it really happen? You can continue to listen at redicemembers.com, acquire a membership and download or stream all of our programs in our archives going back to 2006. We also have videos, films, commentaries, and much more that we're working on right now to help you inform yourself and navigate the oceans of uncertainty. And we do the best we can to offer counter arguments and analyzing the flip side of what the established media and government propaganda offices are spewing out to harness your energy and control the direction that you're heading in. Some of our upcoming guests include Mark Passio, Brian Cannard, Mike Mitchum, and Jesse Ventura. All right, we'll speak to you after the break. Thank you so much for staying with us.